And welcome everybody again to another podcast episode of Berkland Insights. This is the forum where we ask CFOs, CEOs, and VCs how they've managed prior crises and try to learn some to-dos and some best practices out of experiences that these folks have had in prior crises. We think there's a lot of value there. So thanks for joining us. Today we're joined by very happy to have aboard Darius Mirshazadeh. He is a very experienced CEO. He's prior CEO of The Money Source, which was a very tech-enabled disruptor in the mortgage space that was founded in 1997. And he's also the author of a book called The Core Value Equation. Darius has a wealth of knowledge that we wanted to tap and share with our user base or our clientele in terms of how to navigate prior crises. Thanks for joining us, Darius.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Steve. Appreciate it.
So, you know, because of this crisis, and we seem to have spawned another whole crisis in the middle of it, which is kind of a longstanding crisis that has flared back up again. CEOs, I think, could be forgiven for feeling beset by crises after crises. And looking back on your career and the crises that you've managed in the past, what was the scene maybe of the most visible or the most apropos, the most applicable crises? Maybe just kind of set the table for us to understand maybe how this current environment harkens back to one you dealt with in the past.
Yeah, so I spent the last 20 years of my career, fresh out of college, got into the mortgage industry. And that was right after 2000. And for those people that don't remember, you know, right after 9/11, we had a huge refinance boom. Interest rates had never been in the 5% range. Now we're in the 2s. So there was a huge refinance boom, a huge housing boom in the early 2000s. And it really kind of dovetailed out of the 90s. Mm-hmm. There was a recession in the 90s, and there was a nice long run for housing nationally. I mean, nationally went on for decades. What that did is it set up this really interesting environment that created what became known as the subprime meltdown. Mm-hmm. We had a massive, massive implosion in the banking system because of toxic loans that were made by mortgage lenders. And I was a very young and new entrepreneur in the sense of, you know, had businesses, but nothing that had been hugely successful. Mm-hmm. You know, just, you know, the types of businesses you do when you're in college and high school and stuff like that, just kind of these businesses that where you're trying to make money and you don't really know what you're doing. And so the mortgage company I started in 2003 was known as Twin Capital Mortgage. And it was the first high growth, successful company I ever had. We went from myself and an assistant to 150 employees in 36 months.
Wow.
And yeah, I was 25 when I started that. We bootstrapped it. And I was number 40 in Inc. 500, the whole United States. So it was this crazy run. And in August of 2007, the credit markets froze. Mm-hmm. And that affected a large majority of the housing finance market because at that time, most of it was private. I think 50 or 60% of the market was private securitization, and that entire market froze. So what I hearken it to is I would tell people, I said, it would be like if you're in tech and Facebook, Twitter, and Google all blew up.
And AWS, right?
Yeah, and Amazon, like and then some, right? It was like Lehman Brothers went out of business.
I remember very well.
Centuries, you know? And so I was just at the eye of that storm. My business went from, and it was, you know, I was new and young and didn't even, I had no context. Mm-hmm. But by September of 2007, you know, within 4 weeks of that happening, I actually went to the Inc. 500 conference then. It was like a tux black tie ceremony. Mm-hmm. And I joked that I was probably the 50th fastest shrinking company at that conference. So I went from, it was a race to not go out of business. We were like a train that flew off the tracks and we're just skidding towards a cliff. And like literally we went within seconds of going out of business, going bankrupt.
Do you look at the current crisis and look back to the global financial crisis, which really became a systemic issue with the financing system and finance in general and balance sheets and secured collateral default swaps and all of that mess compared to this one? Do you sense a difference? You know, the old saying about it's different this time. I mean, that was a very cyclically driven systemic issue. This is much more event driven. how would startup CEOs look at then and what you learned then versus what they're dealing with now? Similarities, differences, things like that.
That's an interesting question. So I think it was very poignant what happened then, right? We had a bunch of loans and you had derivatives of those loans being right. traded and sold and multiplied the damage over and over and over, you know, exponentially many times over. And you had the world banking system sitting right under that. Mm-hmm. So this is different in some senses, right? In that it's an event-driven situation, but fundamentally the world is more connected now, right? So the fundamentals of the world economy are different. And so an event like an invisible virus can take down the world economy, whereas pre-globalization, it just probably wouldn't have had the same types of effects. Mm-hmm. So I do think that, you know, there's different things that happen that cause these things. And it's funny because people started getting pretty squirrely about the economy, like in 16 and 17, we're like, oh, you know, we've had a great economy now.
We're due.
And then, you know, the next leg up, we're due. Right. And then here we are in 20, and like the most craziest thing is what causes it. So,
right. And now they're all going, see? And even though they had no way of knowing that this
Yeah, was- I love it. You know, it's like armchair quarterback. So I think the lesson that I look at from this perspective is, and you had mentioned something about, you know, people saying CEOs and being thrashed around again. And I have the context of 20 years of this. So I go, you should expect an again,
right.
again. Like right. I run my businesses with the again in mind. And I'm always looking over my shoulder and saying, what if again happens again? Because it's right. going to happen again. And right. I just kind of know that again is part of the equation. And what I find is people, especially successful founders and startups and entrepreneurs, they get really drunk on their success really quickly. And it's funny because I'm like, at this point, I'm young, I'm 42, but I've been an entrepreneur for 20 years. So I feel like I'm like a kind of an older, wiser. That's what I used to be. I used to be the guy that got drunk on my success. And
right.
now I look and when I see people do it, I go, I wouldn't get too comfortable.
Don't get too, yeah.
You know,
yeah, black swans are more common than you think. I've got a couple of years on you and I used to feel the same way. And I'm on my fourth or fifth once in a lifetime crisis, right?
Yeah.
So when they look at their business, and this goes back to when you guys were facing, you know, I'm the fastest shrinking guy at the Inc. 500 conference. It's easy for us to say to a CEO, hey, conserve cash, develop a contingency plan. Stuff. What other aspects of managing through these storms, when you say like, get ready for another crisis, do you do? What did you learn out of those experiences that could be valued to CEOs now beyond the kind of like boilerplate, don't spend any money, right? There's other things that they could be doing. Anything jump to mind?
Well, I think there's a couple things. So it kind of depends on where you're at in the cycle. Right, because it's hard to give everyone the same advice, right? Some sure. people, I would tell them, lean in because you can. It really depends on what's your growth and what's your valuation status at and where are you at in your next funding round, right? If you're thinking of from a more non-PE perspective. Mm-hmm. I come from more of a PE background where we don't get multiples unless we make money, right? Mm-hmm. Day one, we get paid on multiples of EBITDA. So it's a little bit different. So I think having an awareness of where are you in your growth cycle and how's the market view it will kind of give you some insights into how you should spend and how you should cut. But I will say, I see people more often than not just act like it's never going to end.
Yep.
And when I see it, it's like my brain, like I just don't get it. And I tend to run businesses with an ethos around frugality. And having non-exit strategy exits, right?
Right.
So, for instance, I won't sign a lease for more than 36 months, ever. It just won't happen. Because the last lease, I signed a 7-year lease, was the reason I shut down Spring Capital.
Right.
And so I just won't do it.
There's you like, won't do that again.
Even well, if I will.
A good value point for what we're talking about here. Like, you know, keep your expenses close and tight.
Yeah. And so I like to have optionality in my expenses. There are times to lean in and take on the bigger
commitments, maybe.
Yeah, commitments. Yeah, there's moments when you take on the bigger commitments because it absolutely makes sense. But I'm always looking for commitment optionality, right, in my business. I need to have commitment optionality. But I'll say like a couple things that serve me pretty well that I think that I carried with me, and I always tell founders this and CEOs this. The things I do when I'm doing well, I need to be able to do more or less when I'm not doing well. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, when I start designing the culture of a team build, for instance, I don't want to keep leveling up. And I see guys do where it's like they're hiring you know, the next hip hop sensation to come to their Christmas party.
Right.
And my thing's like, it's cool if you can do it, but don't make that the end all be all, because what happens when you're hurting your next round and you have to do a Christmas party at your house?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And potluck. Talking how amazing it was at this one thing, because what happens is it's an event driven, not only is it an event driven crash, it's an event driven business that people are, you're giving them these shots in the arm, your team, and saying, when you do good, this is how I reward you. And I just think that that's like buying your kid a present every time you get a good paycheck. I mean, you don't parent that way, and I don't think you should build a company that way. I want to make it more meaningful. I want to make it more values-driven. I want to be able to do it when we're hurting. Maybe we'll have to tweak it a little bit, but when we're not making money, we should still be able to have the exact same types of team builds. They just may be different. At Twin, we went from doing these crazy parties to, all right, let's go to the food bank and donate our time, and then we'll go to a taqueria in the Mission in San Francisco and have a beer and a taco. Right. And I'll tell you what, those are better team builds.
Probably stickier, yeah.
Way stickier. And so that was a really important thing I learned that I carried with me, which was like, don't make it about the glitz. And don't get me wrong, we still did glitzy stuff, but I didn't make that the norm, and I didn't set the expectations that we were going to keep leveling up.
Okay,
mine was way more about substance. And then the other thing I did that was interesting, that was a really big learning for me, was when you go from 150 employees to 10 employees in 90 days, that's a big suit to fill. Right? That's a lot, large garment you got to like, you have wrapped around a body that's much smaller. And so what was interesting to me was the amount of work we got done with 95% right. of people right. was like 65% the same amount of work.
Right.
And the things that I didn't want to rip the Band-Aid off, because I would have to like streamline an apartment, all this pain I wasn't willing to do when we were big, that I did when I had to do, I was like, man, I should have done that a year sooner.
Right.
And so what I started was a practice where I would constantly go in and optimizing cost cut, constantly. I don't care how well I'm doing, I'm constantly going in and optimizing and cost cutting. And I did that this time around with TMS, where we grew from, you know, a very moderately small company, 30, 40 people, to close to 1,000 people in 36 months. And when I did that, we were cost cutting the whole way up. I don't want to get into our revenue numbers, but they're pretty sizable numbers, consider multitudes, like tens of multitudes bigger than my last business, which ended up being just under a $10 million business. And we did it differently that time. I did team builds that I could sustain in a crash. I was cost cutting the whole way up. And it made it one of those things where when things turned, there was no reason. There's nothing changed. It was like, well, I mean,
just business as usual.
Yeah, fundamentally, nothing's changed, right? So as long as like the revenue side of the business, it can support the expense side, there's nothing to cut, because we're always...
You're already lean. I think your rip the Band-Aid comment is really important. I think a lot of the younger CEOs that we deal with, they haven't been shot at yet, and they have avoided those conversations. And they are kind of, especially in the beginning of the COVID crisis, they were looking around kind of, oh, I hope this goes away, and not really staring into the abyss and acting assertively to maneuver their business, kind of just keeping on with the same expense structure. And now they are all sort of in a place where they're recognizing how much they can get done with a smaller footprint. Did you find when the next one came, they're always different, but did you find it easier to face some of those more difficult conversations knowing that you had been able to conquer them the first time?
My situation, I do not wish my situation upon any CEO. I didn't even get into what like the next 5 years of entrepreneurial purgatory.
Like, right.
Yeah, I didn't make money for 5 years. Like literally I cut checks to go to work for 5 years and didn't pay myself. And so it was really hard. And what happened, if you were an alternative lender, we were called an alt-A lender, mm-hmm. or you were sub, which basically became the word subprime.
Subprime.
Yeah, by the way, they weren't the same word until they became the same word. They were totally separate parts of the market, but they got grouped together once the meltdown happened because they all went bad. I mean, we got out of subprime and went to Alt-A. And so when you were that, you got sued like crazy for the next half a decade. I got lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit for loans that were like normal loans that were being done then. And so one of my big takeaways, which was I got to see everyone behave in their most strongest self-interest throughout that period. Mm-hmm. And I learned a really valuable lesson that if push really comes to shove, every single one of your counterparties, probably within 90 to 95%, will look out for themselves before they look out for you. And so I just always had that in the back of my mind, that I would do the right thing, but only to the point of not putting my own self-interest totally in the trash can.
Interesting.
And so it always made the tougher decisions easier, because I saw how people behaved when push came to shove.
That it was really bad. Yeah.
What I learned was also was your team is there for the opportunity, and most of them are there to be supportive, and they'll take a certain amount of pain as long as they see light at the end of the tunnel. But if there's no light at the end of the tunnel, or the hope is gone, you're going to be handling that all by yourself. Don't kid yourself. Just don't kid yourself. And so what I think a lot of younger founders and less experienced people do, or people that didn't live through what I lived through, is they just kind of give credit where credit's not due for the team that's supposedly going to be there for them. And they make sacrifices for the business, sacrifices for themselves, at the advantage of people that probably aren't going to be there a year later.
Right, and will take advantage of it if they have the opportunity in a downturn, right?
Yeah, and so it's not to say, look, that's human nature, and I'm not faulting anyone for doing it, but I got a little hardened around it, which was, well, I got to do what's best for my family, and I got to do what's best for the business first and foremost, no matter what. I will never make any one person's needs go above that. And sometimes that means you're doing a lot of things that are hard. And so I'll give you a perfect example. I won't cut my pay unless I cut everyone's pay. Mm-hmm. And I will not take my pay down more than theirs. I will cut it exact same amount if I'm going to do it. The reason for that is I don't have a business if I can't get paid. So that's not a real business in my opinion. And so that means either A, I need to cut deeper in the business, or I got to cut everyone's pay more. And if I can't do those, then I shouldn't cut my own pay. Because I did it the other way around. The first thing I did was cut my pay in 07. I literally went from a six-figure paycheck to zero. And I stayed there till 2012. And so that's a long time, right? And that's unusual, right? That's not normal. But these extremes taught me a lot, which was, and I said, I'll never do it again. I'll never cut my pay more than I'll cut someone else's, because it means I don't have a business. If I don't have a business, I should shut the business down. That's a better way of approaching it, because that's not the reason we're there. We're here to build value and get paid for the value we build when we're entrepreneurs.
The mentality shift that you describe, we've also started talking a little bit about that as well. And we've spoken a little bit about the shift that a CEO has to have inside their head. I mean, when you look at a firm like was growing the way you did and then had to shift over to a survival mode, beyond what you just said in terms of the willingness to have those hard conversations and make those hard decisions, what kind of mentality shift do they have to do, you know, about the growth expectations, and how do they manage their investors in that environment where 6 months ago it was all about triple, triple, double, 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 and now it's, hey, I hope we're here in 6 months.
Well, I mean, it's funny. So I'm angel invested in a bunch of deals, and I've had deals that were like these amazing deals that are now zero, right? And so my take on it is those guys are walking into those deals expecting most of them to go to zero. I mean, if they're not, shame on them. And so my take is what's best for the business. And it's always what's best for the business. I don't care who that hurts. If it hurts the investor and it's best for the business, I'm doing it. If it hurts a team player and it's best for the business, I'm doing it. If I have to hurt myself because it's best for the business, as long as it's fair, I'll do it. And so I'm going to have a transparency. I'm going to give them updates. They put their money in the deal. There's a respect I owe them. But I'm not here to do anything except for what's best for the business. That's why they hired me to be the CEO. That's why they put the money into the deal. And if they don't respect that, they put the money in the wrong deal. They should look elsewhere.
So from the CEO's perspective, when they have to kind of reset their own expectations, there's sometimes a lot of daylight between where I was versus where I need to be now. And they have to get to what you just described. But if they have never done that before, that's tough to go from, you know, I was on the road 6 months ago trying to raise a $10 million Series A, and I owe these guys because they put all this money into the deal. And now they got to go and say, hey, listen, I know you're putting all this pressure on me to grow, but I can't right now. I need to stay alive. That's a shift, right?
Yeah, I think like for me, I take kind of a Zen approach to running the business, which is the market is what it is. My business currently is what it is. The numbers are what they are, right? And so I can pull levers to change some of those, but not all of them. I can't change the market. I can change the strategy.
You can't change COVID.
I can't change COVID, but I can maybe pivot, right? If the strategy calls for that. The market is what it is. My strategy is what it is, as long as we all keep on that railway. And the numbers are what they are. And so if I'm getting pressure from anyone to outperform what I'm working with, it's on me to set their expectations straight, including my own. Mm-hmm. So this is what I was talking about before, where entrepreneurs, they get drunk on their success, and then they don't want to face reality that that's maybe not the place that they're at right now. I will tell you, every good crisis, there's opportunity. So my perspective that I didn't take last time, which was a really good learning opportunity, was I got really down on myself. And my take is, man, listen, it's great to kill it when everyone's killing it, but there's way more opportunity when everyone's getting crushed. That's mm-hmm. when you can really set yourself apart. I saw so many of my buddies go from running $500,000 companies to 100 plus million dollar companies in valuation because of the chaos that happened in the last cycle. So I'm looking at this cycle and I'm like, where's the opportunity? Like the minute the chaos came on, like, there's going to be tons of opportunity. So,
well, that's a great place. Let's pivot to there, because you mentioned pivot earlier, and this is a really important place for us to go on the podcast is, yes, this crisis has happened. Yes, business has been shut down. We can't go to work, social distancing, all this sort of stuff. But the ability to see through that, through to what you just described, I think is, like you said, what sort of separates the wheat from the chaff a little bit. Where does that go? What are the things you look for as a CEO to understand how to pivot, where to pivot, what's the right time in a crisis? You know, the climb out is sometimes where the most value is built, not when the horn is blowing and everybody's like, yay, we're safe, right? By that point, it's too late. So what do you look for there?
I started looking at where were people around me getting traction. And so I will say, when people are running away from something, when they're sprinting away from an area, I think those are the areas where there's gonna be the next opportunity. You don't want to be too early, but that's where I think being a little bit futuristic and saying, are they sprinting away for the right reasons, or is this just a knee-jerk reaction? Were they super hot on this before and now they're not? Another thing that I learned from the last cycle was, I learned also on the scale up of this cycle, is you want to look for two things. Where is their heavy margin? I don't want to be in a commoditized, crowded,
3% a year, right?
Yeah, low margin, just fighting for scraps business. Like, I want to have a big opportunity, or I want it to be super niche with crazy margins.
With real profitability,
right? And then the other thing that I learned, this was a massive takeaway, because I did pivot. I pivoted out of alternative lending, you know, subprime lending, into reverse mortgage. It was, at the time, was a smart pivot, but then that market crashed 2 years later.
That got hurt, yeah.
And I got hurt. That was just bad luck. Right? A lot of this is luck. That's why I say don't get drunk on your success, because half of that success is just luck. You just
got in the right place. That's right. Like, well, the reverse mortgage thing is a great example. That was hot for like 2 years, right?
Yeah. So this is from 2007, 8, yep. 9. It was hot until May of 2009. And then that secondary market crashed.
Same with SPACs and pipes and all that stuff.
Right. So I always say, like, you know, go where people are running away from, look for market opportunity, but look for some heavy margin. Those are the things that I like to look at, because at least if it starts getting crowded, I got some margin to play with, right? Mm-hmm. Be a little futuristic. If it's something people are running away from, are they running away for the wrong reason? And is that really a fundamentally good market? Because it'll come back if it is.
Right.
And you want to be the leader when it comes back, or you want to own a niche in that area when it comes back.
And have it be defendable, right?
Totally. So the other thing, and this is something that I learned in the reverse mortgage space, is you got to have scale in the sale. So when you go in there, and again, if you're disrupting, or if you're creating your own category, a lot of times you're trying to figure product market fit, and you're trying to see, is there scale in the sale? But let's just say that there is product market fit. Well, how good is the scale in the sale? Are your salespeople quitting like crazy because they can't get traction? Why? That's the question you should always ask. Don't just say because they're bad salespeople. A good product to sell is a product that a mediocre salesperson can sell. I always look at it that way. If my mediocre guys are making a living, it's a pretty good product.
Then you're on the right track. Yep.
Yeah. I don't want just my top producers, the guy that could produce despite the system they were in. I don't want that to be. That means there's not scale in my sales. So those are things I looked at through the lens of a pivot to say, look where people are running away from. Is there a fundamental issue with the market? What's the future of that market look like? Is there scale in the sale? Those are the four things I'm looking at whenever I launch any business. Mm-hmm. And if I don't get it in a timely manner, and that my strategy says that I should get it in XYZ time, then I'm going to really look and say, why am I not getting it?
And when you would look at those things, just to hold you there, when you would look at those things, would you look at a build it, an acquisition, try to, like, so you're a CEO, you're looking at your world right now and all of those things you just said, Do I go buy a competitor? Do you give us your thoughts a little bit on what that mechanism, and obviously it's always context dependent, but should CEOs be looking to buy, start new businesses, invest in the one they have?
Yes, and all, right. Yeah, sure. Yes to all of them or no to all of them, depending, right? So if you got a bunch of cash, I would be scooping people up. If you have a positioning or a defendable position that's like stronger than the other guys, I'd go work deals with them and bring them in under your umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Do an acqui-hire maybe, things like that.
Yeah, like what I found is people get really creative when there's no cash, but there's a lot of opportunity. And mm-hmm. So like you can go, if you have the platform that those guys need, maybe you can work a deal where you can work deals, entrepreneurial deals with other entrepreneurs to bring them in under your umbrella and let them build their product as part of your product, right? So there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. I wouldn't get stuck on the traditional models because guess what? The VCs aren't getting stuck on their normal model that they were playing off of a year ago. Their behavior just changed. Your behavior can change.
Right. I think you hit on a really important thing. Other entrepreneurs will make deals, right? You don't need to necessarily have a huge war chest. If everybody around the table is a creative entrepreneur, they're going to find ways to work together.
The way I became CEO of TMS was a joint venture deal I put together because my partner didn't want to sell the company to me and he had a great platform and I liked his platform. And so we did a JV that I converted into equity and merged the two together at a certain point and became the CEO. So I've built the last 10 years of my career off of doing deals like that. And those deals are easier to do than acquisitions. They're just done in a different way. There's a lot of ways to win. This is a really, really good example. I have a buddy who is the most successful person I know. And I'm not going to say much about him, except he has a 9-figure net worth and he owns a professional sports team.
Okay? Awesome.
And so he is super successful. This guy, I had just read Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference. This guy is the best negotiator I know personally. And I just read Never Split the Difference, book all about negotiating. And I call him up and he says something to me that's super funny. He goes, you know, everyone always says never make the first offer. I always make the first offer. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I just read a book that basically coached me on how not to do that. From a guy that saved people's lives in the FBI. The answer to the test is this, they're both right.
Right. And it depends on the context and where you are and what you're trying to accomplish.
Totally. Yeah. So awesome. I've learned there's a lot of different ways to win. And what I used to do is really get stuck on how other people figured out their ways of winning. And I like to take a step back from that now and say, look, even if I was in the exact same scenario, my outcome would probably be slightly different. So I just need to figure out how to win with my own skill set, my own knowledge. And then I want to learn from other people's experiences so I can then take from it what I can to make my own decisions.
You index it in your own decision. You're not just going to copy the other guy. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, that's helpful.
That's a great place to leave it. Find a way to win. This has been great. That is a great way to sort of sum up what we've been trying to do with these podcasts. So just to wrap this up, we've been speaking with Darius Mirshazadeh. And, you know, again, thank you very much for joining us. This has been another episode of Berkland Insights. Thanks for coming.